Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello, and thank you for joining me on this edition of our English feature program. I'm Philippa Hitchin. Coming up today, numbers of English Catholics wanting to celebrate the old Tridentine rite are reportedly on the rise. But how many priests really know how to do it? Concern over a recent outbreak of violence in East Timor, why the Catholic Church should be in the forefront of the struggle to help the island nation embrace democracy. But first, Pope Benedict XVI remembers all those who've been killed or made homeless by the flooding across Southeast Asia. Welcome to the programme. Speaking to crowds of faithful gathered at his summer residence of Castel Gandolfo on Sunday, Pope Benedict prayed for all those who have lost their lives in the devastating floods over large parts of Southeast Asia. The Pope also looked ahead to the Feast of the Assumption, which will be celebrated on Wednesday, as my colleague Chris Altieri reports.
Gravi inondazioni hanno devastato vari paesi del sud-est asiatico.
In remarks to the pilgrim faithful gathered in the courtyard of the Apostolic Summer Residence at Castel Gandolfo, the Holy Father called on the international community to give immediate and generous support to those suffering the effects of the flooding, who he said are our brothers and sisters. The Holy Father said he shares in the suffering of all those who have been touched by the situation and called on ecclesial communities everywhere to pray for the victims and to make concrete gestures of solidarity with those who are, he said, indeed hard-pressed. Speaking before the Angelus prayer, Pope Benedict called on the faithful to be mindful of the future, ever vigilant and attentive to the last things, death, judgment, eternity, hell and heaven. Remembering this week's solemn Feast of the Assumption, Pope Benedict said, Mary, the Holy Virgin, went before us to heaven in joy. Pope Benedict prayed that the Virgin Mary, who watches over us from heaven, might help us not to forget that we are but for a season here on earth, and ask that she teach us to prepare ourselves to meet with Jesus, who sits at the right hand of God the Almighty Father. From there, he shall come to judge the living and the dead. After the Angelus prayer, Pope Benedict greeted the faithful in many languages, including English.
Jesus exhorts his disciples to be watchful, ever ready to greet him when he comes. During these quiet days of summer, may we welcome the Lord ever more fully into our hearts and allow his grace to transform our lives. Upon you and your families, I cordially invoke God's blessing of joy and peace.
I'm Chris Altieri.
The political situation in East Timor remains extremely tense following the swearing-in last week of a new coalition government headed by Prime Minister and former independence hero Xanana Gusmão. Violent protests were reported mainly in the east of the island nation by supporters of the former ruling party Fretlin, which won most seats in the June election but was excluded from the coalition government. Scores of homes have been burnt and buildings vandalised, including a Salesian convent, since the new government was appointed by President José Ramos Horta last Monday. The latest violence has raised fears of a return to the factional fighting which claimed the lives of more than 30 people and forced thousands more to flee their homes last year. About 3,000 international police and troops are currently in the impoverished nation to try and maintain order. Sister Susan Connolly is Assistant Director of the Mary MacKillop East Timor Institute, based in Sydney, Australia. She told my colleague Lydia O'Kane the international community, including the Catholic Church, must help the Timorese people as they struggle to overcome the current outbreak of violence, as well as the deep-seated wounds of the past.
It's a struggling nation trying to come to grips with their own internal trauma from the civil war in 75 and the invasion by Indonesia and the complete lack of interest for the rest of the world, including the worldwide church, I must say, up until recent times. They've got dealing with all that, and then they've got the process of democracy that they're trying to deal with. The fact is, 71% of the people did not vote for the Fretland Party. And unfortunately, it seems that the Fretland Party and their supporters have not yet been able to come to terms with that loss of power. But of course, we are very concerned, and it's sad to see this. But I think that the world has got to stand behind this young nation. Look, if we don't get it right in Timor, there's not much hope for lots of other places.
You posed the question, what can the church do? What can we do for this nation? It must be something you're thinking about a lot within your own organisation.
Mm. We should give them all the assistance that they deserve. And the greatest assistance, I believe, is to the educational opportunities. We nations of the world should be lining up to say to the new government, what can we do to help your people to make up for the 500 years of total neglect, so that the people have got the ability then to put the democracy that they've fought and died for into operation. Now, really practical things like the whole middle management area is missing in Timor, because all the middle managers were Indonesians and they left, and you're left with this huge vacuum. So they've got a tremendously idealistic, but the practicality of it is missing in a lot of cases. And really, as far as the church is concerned, we in the church, you know, they're 93% Catholic there. We should be saying to them, what can we do? What can we do as a church to help your priests, who are all traumatised men, who bore a tremendous burden? We know some of these men. We had a priest living here with us, you know, for 3 months, a beautiful man, and it's such a struggle for him. He had a gun pull at his head on Easter Sunday, 1999. They pulled the trigger and the gun didn't go off. Now, multiply that by goodness knows how many. And, of course, the burden that they've borne, these men, you know, with feeling so responsible for the peoples in their parish. So, I'm not talking about money so much. I mean, it partly is about money. You need to have infrastructure, etc. But to be able to go to Timor, this is what people ought to do. Go to Timor, find out, and then in small groups or parishes or whatever, get behind the parishes there that are all over the place and so full of people, and support the individual parishes in what they need to do. You'll find that every parish in Timor has about 10 churches. So there's huge amounts. The whole catechetical area. I know a priest who sometimes has 400 people for baptism every week. How do you evangelise 400 people? Like, it's nearly impossible. But so we mustn't just say to them now, oh, Lord, you know, there's a few street fights and there's stone throwing. Oh, you know, you're hopeless. This is a signal. This is a cry for help. We, the world and the church, have got to get behind these people.
I suppose when you see this unrest, I suppose it triggers fears of an end to a kind of a fragile peace that has held out since mid-2006, you know, when you had this violent feuding between rival army. And it obviously will. Obviously people will look to that and go, gosh, are we seeing a return to this? Because obviously we don't want it.
Mm. Of course, the problem that you're talking about is the weakness of the institutions, the army, the police, the courts, the whole health system, the whole government system. You know, the last financial year, the government did not spend the whole budget, poor and all as it was, $147 million American dollars, and they didn't spend it because of the lack of know-how, basically. And it is up to us, to all people, regardless of religion, to get in and do what we can. And I'm really pleased our troops and they are there to help them on with it. But the people need to have ways, when things settle down, of learning about a democracy, the rights and responsibilities of living in a democracy, because the experience has been denied them and they're going to have to learn it on the run. And what we're seeing now is maybe a couple of mistakes they're making in the learning of that.
There's so much to do, and it's almost like you say, don't let the violence get in the way of moving forward to make it a better nation.
Yes, that's right. But I suppose it is about looking forward in that. But I also think that a lot of what's going on at the moment among these people, Xanana and Ramos Horta and Marie Alkatiri, and all those men who've come, who really 1975 men coming, a lot of this is about the past, the unaddressed past. I mean, there was a civil war in Timor in 1975, a two-week civil war, partly fomented by Indonesia, because they could see it coming, and it was a way of coming in and saying, well, we're going to save you from yourselves. But it was a civil war, and about 1,500 Timorese were killed by other Timorese. Now, that has never been addressed. Families have never really had the chance because of what happened to them right at the end of the civil war, invaded by the fourth largest army in the world. And all that terrible trauma that they had for the next 24 years. And now the last 6 or 7 years getting on their feet with the democracy. The whole process of human understanding of reconciliation with someone who's wronged you, they really haven't been able to sit down and do that on a large scale. And that's a very important thing. There are a lot of people talking about that up there. There have been moves to capitalise on the existing community village type reconciliation process that has existed in Timor for hundreds of years. That has been used to a certain extent with people who committed lower order crimes, particularly recently. But as for really being able to say, look what happened to us, look what we did to each other, that has not happened. So it's seething underneath.
My thanks there to Sister Susan Connolly of the Mary MacKillop East Timor Institute, speaking to my colleague Lydia O'Kane. The Latin Mass Society of England and Wales is reporting an upsurge of interest in the Tridentine Mass following Pope Benedict's recent motu proprio allowing for a wider use of the old rite. The Pope's decision to relax restrictions on the use of the Tridentine Mass, which was sidelined following the reforms of the Second Vatican Council, has also sparked something of a cottage industry in helping priests learn how to celebrate the old rite and track down appropriate vestments to wear. A training course at Oxford, as well as a website, a helpline and a selection of DVDs are among resources springing up for priests who want to celebrate this older rite, but simply lack the knowledge or experience to do so. My colleague Susie Hodges has been taking a closer look.
With a whole generation of priests having grown up only knowing the new rite, there's a manifest need for the clergy to learn the elaborate rituals of the Tridentine Mass. Apart from its most obvious difference of being celebrated in Latin rather than the local language, the Tridentine Mass has a host of rules, including which vestments can be used, what material they should be made of, where the candles should be placed on the altar, and the precise position of the priest's hands at various points throughout the Mass, to name but a few. To help young priests learn to celebrate the Tridentine Mass with knowledge and confidence, the Latin Society has organised a 3-day major training conference at Oxford University later on this month. The Society's manager is John Medlin, and he said the response to their course was greater than expected, with more than 40 priests applying to take part.
The conference has aroused a great deal of interest, and even though we knew there was a large amount of subdued interest out in the country, we ourselves have been taken aback by the degree of response we've had.
Medling goes on to spell out the aims of this conference.
We should be trying to provide information and training across the board, so there will be intensive sessions on the history of the traditional rite, on its particular spirituality and its devotional aspects. And then there will be intensive hands-on sessions in which the priests actually practice the rubrics of the traditional rite. that we hope to give them a complete taster, shall we say, of what it is to celebrate the traditional rite, so that they go away from the conference with enough knowledge and with enough backup material by way of books and training notes and so on to enable them to celebrate certainly the low mass in the traditional rite more or less immediately on their return to their parishes.
One of the keynote speakers at the training conference in Oxford is Dr. Alcuin Reid, a liturgy scholar and author of a 2005 book published by Ignatius Press entitled The Organic Development of the Liturgy, that has a preface written by Pope Benedict when he was Cardinal Ratzinger. Reid told me more about the main theme of his book.
The main point is that throughout the history of the liturgy has developed gradually. There haven't been sudden changes imposed by authority, but such changes as there have been, and there certainly have been many, have been gradual over the generations, over the centuries, and that overall there is a continuity in liturgical development.
So what exactly is the future Pope, Cardinal Ratzinger, saying in his preface to Alcuin's book?
He was saying that the liturgy is first and foremost about God. And he said, I think I'm quoting accurately, that the most imminent danger of our age is that we can forget God, and that the liturgy needs to be focused on God. And of course, that's the theme of his desire expressed in Sacramentum Caritatis as Pope. It's also partially behind his freeing up the use of the more ancient use of Mass. The Catholic worship is about the worship of God, and sometimes in recent years we've forgotten that. Also in the preface to my book, Cardinal Ratzinger spoke of the liturgical movement of the 20th century and how its hopes and desires for a thorough renewal of liturgical spirituality, of liturgical feeling in the Catholic Church, were somewhat frustrated by what happened in the late 1950s and 1960s and in the coming decades. And he said, in fairly strong words, he said that he himself, who was a young man, was part of that liturgical movement and had great hopes, looked back and looked and saw what they had hoped for lying in ruins. And I think we can understand that young man who grew up, who was part of the reform of the Second Vatican Council, an expert at the council, who was a young priest and then a pastoral bishop and then called to Rome. Looking back over those years, he was very disappointed with the way things went, and now as Pope, gently, moderately, as is his way, is trying to sow the seeds or lay the foundations, perhaps for a new liturgical revival. Some people even say, and use his phrase from his book in 2000, The Spirit of the Liturgy, possibly he's sowing the seeds of a new liturgical movement, where in the Church of the 21st century, yes, we'll have different forms of the celebration of Mass, but they'll all be celebrated in that liturgical spirit, which was part of the original liturgical movement, part of what the Second Vatican Council wanted, and very much part of what themes Pope Benedict XVI is trying to call the Church to again today.
So, what are the qualities that are attracting so many people, especially the young, to a growing interest in the Tridentine Mass? Medlin again.
Well, both priests and faithful tend to find in the traditional rite of Mass a much greater sense of the supernatural, a much greater sense of encounter with mystery, a much greater depth of doctrine and spirituality. That's not to say, of course, for one moment that the new rite is necessarily deficient in those areas, but simply to say that there is a large and a growing number of people and priests out in the wider world who specifically find in the traditional rite a special way of access to those things.
That view of the Tridentine Mass having more sense of mystery and the supernatural is shared by Reid.
I think if one looks at how they're usually celebrated or perceived, the more modern rite can seem a little bit more imminent and a little less transcendent, though of course the Holy Father in Sacramentum Caritatis has tried to remind us that the modern rites need to be celebrated in a very godly or godward manner, whereas the older rites tend to be simply because of the rituals, because it's usually celebrated facing east and so on, more transcendent in its orientation. The Latin, of course, helps that as well.
The use of Latin to celebrate the Tridentine Mass is probably the most obvious first difference between the old and new rites. But given that Latin is often no longer spoken by priests of the younger generation, how daunting is it for them to take on board a completely new language when celebrating the liturgy? Medlin again.
Well, in fact, some seminaries do still teach the Latin language, and a good number of the younger priests have taught themselves the sufficiency of Latin as they've developed their interest in the traditional rite over the past few years. We will be providing further sessions in Latin, remedial sessions, as you might say, in Latin, so that all those priests attending the conference should have sufficient grasp of the language to enable them to understand the rubrics and to understand the actual texts of the Mass. At the end of the day, you don't need to be fluent in Latin, in the Latin language as such. You don't need to be able to discuss the weather, for instance, in Latin, to have a sufficiency to be able to offer the traditional rite.
Apart from the question of Latin, what about the vestments and ecclesial accessories required for celebrating the old rite? Reed says many are similar to those used for the new rite, but not all of them.
The traditional use are really very similar to the ones in the modern use. Perhaps some people would associate a certain shape, you know, the squarer shape of chasuble of vestment with the older form of Mass, though that's not necessarily the case. There's no rule saying that can't be used in the modern form. Perhaps the big difference is the maniple, the vestment which is worn on the left sleeve, a little bit like a handkerchief, a towel. That was made optional after the Second Vatican Council and then not included in the Missal of Paul VI. That's the only major difference in the vesting of the priest. The older form of Mass, you would often find, of course, that people would tend to use vestments which are silk, and there's a rule saying that vestments should be made of silk and so on, and their decorations would probably be more classical.
In the wake of the Second Vatican Council, Medlin says many of the vestments and other items were thrown out or stashed away in cupboards of parish churches or even stored by the faithful. He says there's now a determined effort to track down these items, and new vestment makers are springing up to meet the demand.
It is a very sad truth that after the Second Vatican Council, a large number of vestments and ecclesiastical items were indeed thrown away. But it is also the truth that a large quantity of these items were in fact preserved, either by the clergy themselves putting things away in cupboards in the parish sacristies, or by the faithful rescuing these items and keeping them carefully in their private homes, in some cases for decades. So there is more of these sorts of items currently available than you might think. At the same time, there are now specialist companies who exist to track down these items and to sell them on to priests or to parishes interested in equipping themselves to celebrate the traditional rite. And indeed, there is now such a demand that some of these companies are now commissioning new items, which are often made by some of the younger religious communities.
Reed explains how, in addition to the vestments question, the old rite laid out elaborate rules on how the priest should move and the gestures he should make during the course of the Mass.
There are many rules, and perhaps that's a little daunting for somebody, perhaps priests or people involved in preparing the liturgy who might consider becoming involved. That might seem a little daunting. I think one can get bogged down in too many of the details, and yes, you know, one does have to learn certain things in terms of how to behave, how to make ritual gestures. Language needs to be learned and so on. That's one of the reasons we're having this conference in Oxford, to begin that process. The differences, everything is part of a whole body of ritual developed over the centuries of the Church's tradition, which, once one is familiar with those rituals, they take on a form of praying which is perhaps very different to the way the modern rite is celebrated, which, as I say, can seem much more practical, perhaps, and much more modern.
Gloria in excelsis Deo.
Another key difference, says Reed, concerns the role of the priest himself during the old rite.
The rite has a certain regulation of the priest. The priest's personality is sublimated, is immersed into the ritual, and that he's not really the central focus of attention, but that the whole rite, including what the priest does with his hands, with his eyes, with his voice, so on, is leading the person to the worship of Almighty God through the rite, through the sacrifice of the Mass, rather than, as sometimes happens in the modern rite, the personality of the priest taking over.
As we learnt earlier, several dozen priests from England and Wales have signed up to attend this training conference on how to celebrate the Tridentine Mass. But does Medlin have any idea how much interest there is among the Catholic clergy in general in Britain in celebrating this form of the liturgy?
Well, to be frank, your guess on that matter is as good as mine. It is unfortunately the case that up until the motu proprio, a large number of priests felt wary of indicating to their bishops that they had an interest in the traditional rite. And therefore they also felt wary of indicating to organisations such as the Latin Mass Society they had such an interest. I suspect, it's very difficult to put an accurate figure on this, I suspect the figure, particularly amongst the younger priests, of those with an interest is between 10 and 15%. That's not to say that all these young priests wish to move across to celebrating the traditional rite exclusively, of course not. It does mean they wish to know more about the rite and to be fluent in it, and therefore to be bi-ritual priests who are able to fulfil the requests of the faithful made to them for reverent and devout celebrations either in the new or in the old rite.
But you say there is a growing interest, and that was even before the motu proprio came out.
Oh, indeed, yes. The interest began to grow noticeably in the final years of Pope John Paul II's reign. It began to grow exponentially in the first 2 years of Pope Benedict's reign, and now it's moved on to a new plane again after the motu proprio.
Pope Benedict's motu proprio, relaxing the restrictions on celebrating the Tridentine Mass, makes clear that the two rites can coexist side by side. And according to Reed, the fact that there is nothing obligatory about the papal decree is reassuring for the faithful.
Most of the faithful, I think, are quite happy because the Pope hasn't insisted that what's happening in their parish churches on Sunday mornings is going to change. You know, he's not imposed anything on anybody. He's permitted those who wish to have the older form of Mass to have it more freely, certainly, but he's not insisting on anything happening which will change the way people wish to worship. There's been a lot of discussion, of course, in various Catholic journals and amongst clergy, but that's more at the theoretical level, and I think some of that has missed the point, that the Pope hasn't insisted that the old Mass be used. He's simply allowing it where people really want it.
Susie Hodges speaking there to liturgy scholar and author Alcuin Reed, and earlier to the manager of the Latin Mass Society, John Medlin. And that's all from me, Philippa Hitchin, and from all of us here at the English programme for today. Join us again at this same time tomorrow if you can, or find us on the internet, www.vaticanradio.org/English. For now, stay tuned to Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.